Uttamascha
Dhruvaschobhav.
Anyonyam Prema Vivalo.
Angasangat
Utpulakav. Asrogham Muhur Uhutuhu.
The two brothers, Uttam and Dhruv Maharaj, also exchanged their tears. They were overwhelmed by the ecstasy of love and affection, and when they embraced one another, the hair on their bodies stood up.
Sunitir Astya Janani Pranebhyo Pi Priyam Sudam Upaguya Jahav Adhim Tadangasparsha Nibrita.
Suniti, the real mother of Dhruv Maharaj, embraced the tender body of her son, who was dearer to her than her own life, and thus forgot all material grief, for she was very pleased.
Payastanabhyam Shushruva Netra Jai Salilai Shivai Tadabhishyam Manabhyam Vira Vira Subho Muhu.
My dear Vidura, Suniti was the mother of a great hero. Her tears, together with the milk flowing from her breasts, wet the whole body of Dhruva Maharaj. This was a great auspicious sign. Purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. When deities are installed, they are washed with milk, yogurt, and water. And this ceremony is called Abhishek. In this verse, it has been especially mentioned that the tears which flowed down from the eyes of Suniti were all auspicious. This auspiciousness of the Abhishek ceremony performed by his beloved mother was an indication that in the very near future, Dhruv Maharaj would be installed on the throne of his father. The history of Dhruva Maharaj's leaving home was that his father refused to give him a place on his lap, and Dhruva Maharaj determined that unless he got the throne of his father, he would not come back. Now, this Abhishek ceremony performed by his beloved mother was an indication that he would occupy the throne of Maharaj Uttanapada. Significant in this verse that Suniti, mother of Dhruva Maharaj, is described as Virasu, a mother who produced a great hero. There are many heroes in this world, but there is no comparison to Dhruva Maharaj, who is not only a heroic emperor of this planet, but also a great devotee. A devotee is also a great hero because he conquers the influence of Maya. When Lord Chaitanya inquired from Ramananda Rai about the most famous man in this world, the latter replied that anyone who is known as a great devotee of the Lord is to be accepted as the most famous. In this chapter, Dhruva Maharaj has just entered again into the kingdom of his father, Uttanapada. Such an emotional experience is taking place amongst these great souls. It is told by Maitreya Rishi to Vidura how Dhruva Maharaj left home because he was severely inflicted by the insulting words of his stepmother, Suruchi, and by the neglect of his father. He went to the forest, determined to seek revenge. His stepmother said, "You cannot sit on the throne of your father because you are not born of my womb." He was determined to gain a throne with a kingdom greater than his father, his great-grandfather, or his grandfather. So his motivation was very much based on animosity and revenge toward his brother and his stepmother. Due to the association with Sri Narada Muni, he was taught the process of devotional service, which cleanses the heart of all anarthas, unwanted attachments. Through chanting the name of the Lord in a holy place of Vrindavan, Madhuban, performing austerities to control his senses, and fixing his mind exclusively on the form of the Lord within his heart, Dhruva Maharaj became pure. So pure that Lord Narayan personally appeared before his eyes, offered him any benediction. Dhruva Maharaj was ashamed. Ashamed that he approached the Lord for material desires. The Lord knew his heart and actually gave him the kingdom of this world for 36,000 years, as well as the throne of the kingdom of a planet even greater than that of Brahma, a spiritual planet within this universe called Suttala, Dhruvaloka. So, Dhruva Maharaj was very much ashamed. "Why are you giving me these things? It is all like broken pieces of glass. I have achieved the rare diamond of your mercy, of your darshan. I am satisfied." The Lord sent Dhruva Maharaj home. He's only 5 years old. Uttanapada, when he saw that his son entered into the forest, his heart was broken. He lamented terribly for the neglectful offense that he had committed to his son. He was convinced that he would never see his son again. A five-year-old child entering into the forest, away for so many months, what is the possibility of him coming back alive? He was convinced that Dhruva is dead. Therefore, he considered himself the cause of the pain and the death of his own child. He lamented pitiably, filled with shame and remorse, considering himself the most cruel-hearted, sinful person. He received word from Narada Muni that Dhruva Maharaj was to attain the perfection of life by having the darshan of Lord Vishnu, and soon he would return home. But still, the fatherly nature of Uttanapada, considering the frail, tender body of this very small child, really could not believe such words. And when a messenger came to tell that Dhruva Maharaj is on his way home, even then, Uttanapada Maharaj just couldn't believe it's possible that he could have survived. But because he also heard it from Narada Muni, there was hope in his heart. There was a small forest just outside the kingdom. Dhruva Maharaj entered into that forest. How many miles he walked to get there. When he arrived, King Uttanapada was waiting on his chariot to bring Dhruva Maharaj back to the palace. Uttanapada was ecstatic, embracing his child again and again and again, offering sweet words of love. And then Uttama, his brother, the two of them embraced. And it describes in these verses we read today how as Uttama and Dhruva were embracing, although previously they were like enemies, they were weeping and crying, bathing each other with tears of ecstasy. And their hairs were standing on end. Actually had ecstatic love for each other. And Dhruva Maharaj then fell at the feet of his two mothers. His real mother, Suniti, and then his stepmother, Suruchi, whose wicked, envious heart caused him the greatest pain that he ever experienced in his life. She hurt him so bad. She offended him so severely that even as a small 5-year-old child, he couldn't bear being in the same kingdom with her. That's how much she hurt him. He left home for the forest to get revenge on her. But here he's falling at her feet, offering her obeisances. And Suruchi, seeing Dhruva's pure godly qualities, completely detached from any of the phenomena of material existence, completely absorbed in pure devotional service, even her heart melted. And she embraced Dhruva and blessed him by saying, "Let you live a long life. May you be prosperous." This is very instructive. In this world, there are so many reasons by which animosity, conflict, even enmity can be created between people, whether we're small people or great people. And that enmity may burn like fire in the heart. And it seems that there's no way to possibly quench the thirst of vengeance within such a person's heart. But because Dhruva Maharaj became pure, Vishayavanivartante niraharasideyana dasavarajamrasopyasya param drishtvanivartate, he experienced the higher taste of Krishna. Therefore, he was above and beyond the dualities of friendship and enemies of this world. This was Prahlad Maharaj's instructions to his 5-year-old classmates, that material education is basically on the principle of how to satisfy your ego, and in order to do that, you have to understand who is your friend and who is your enemy, and how to deal with your friends to exploit the most from them, and how to conquer your enemies so they cannot exploit you. That is material life. To the degree we are attached to our own egoistic conceptions of life, we are on that platform, whether we know it or not. We exploit our friends for our own selfish purposes, and we try to destroy our enemies in various ways so that they cannot exploit us. But Prahlad Maharaj told his friends that, "I cannot see in terms of friends and enemies. It's impossible for me to think in those terms. Because I have love for Krishna. And I see every living being as part of Krishna. Therefore, I see every living being as an object of my love and my compassion and my respect." That was Prahlad Maharaj's realization. It is that state of consciousness that is the solution to the problems of the world. There is no alternative to that. Prahlad Maharaj told his friends that the solutions to the problems of this world on the basis of material adjustments simply creates a problem greater than the original problem. We see that in our society today. The solutions to little problems appear very nice to the immediate perception of the mind and senses. But in due course of time, it leads to a greater problem than the original problem. And what's the solution? Another material adjustment, which seems to work very nicely, but in the end, it creates even greater problem. And what is the solution? Another material adjustment, which seems to be working very nicely. But after some time, it creates even a bigger problem. And in Kali Yuga, such immense problems are here. Now there's problems that people do not know how to solve. One of the biggest problems on the planet that political leaders are discussing amongst themselves, but they don't discuss it much amongst the ordinary people because they don't have a solution, is the destruction of the atmosphere, the ozone atmosphere, due to so many pollutions, which are created. Why? Because they wanted to solve some problems. It's hot, solve the problem, create an air conditioner. But then the type of gas that you have to put in the air conditioner destroys the ozone. If the ozone is destroyed, then greenhouse effect, the heat does not escape properly, and then the sun's ultraviolet rays are not properly filtered by Krishna's natural arrangement in terms of the atmosphere, and it creates a cancerous situation, creates global warming. It could be the cause of the entire destruction of continents. The solar ice caps start melting because of this effect, and then the oceans rise. You happen to be right on the banks of the ocean here in Bombay. And it's inevitable. These things are going to happen. New Vrindavan is in the middle of America. It's in the middle of America. It's about 1,000 miles from the nearest ocean. But years ago, in 1969, Prabhupada said, someday this will be a tropical place right near the ocean. How is that possible? But then we read in the reports of these geologists that are reporting today, they're saying eventually, yes, West Virginia is going to be a seacoast beach town like Jagannath Puri. Ocean, sand, palm trees, no winters, Haribo. And I'll be honest with you, that prophecy is what kept many of us through the winters there. Hope against hope, someday this is going to be a tropical place. No heat anywhere. Up to the knees in ice and snow. Frigid polar winds blowing, torturous, no proper clothes. We would think, if we just stay here long enough, someday this is going to be a tropical place. You can bathe in the ocean at New Vrindavan. But this is what the geologists say. It's just a matter of time. So such a problem, and what's the solution to the problem? Very, very difficult. The damage is done. If we want to keep from doing more damage, we actually have to reverse the whole way the civilization has been going. People don't like to walk, so they create automobiles. It's a solution. But look at the problem. I happened to overhear in Radha Gopinath Prabhu's Bhagavad Gita course, he was describing that just breathing in Bombay is equal to smoking so many packs of cigarettes every day. Yes? Sometimes I spy on your classes. take notes for my purification.
How many?
Huh?
Per day. 3 packs of cigarettes per day. Huh? Yeah. Huh?
Whatever it is, a lot of cigarettes.
That means all this pollution is going right into your lungs. All you're doing is breathing.
And then what's going to happen in the future? Lung cancer and heart disease and all of these other diseases that come from pollution.
So big, big problems. So there's only one solution, and that's to change consciousness.
So Dhruva Maharaj, upon becoming Krishna conscious, his whole consciousness was transformed.
And the same woman he was so hateful and revengeful toward, with love and affection in his heart, he is respectfully offering obeisances at her feet.
And seeing such a transcendental personality and knowing how much she hurt him, and yet he's so humble, he's so loving, he's so respectful, her heart melted. And here she's giving Dhruva Maharaj's benedictions. She's wishing him all well. May you live long. Happy at the thought that he may be the next king. His Krishna conscious position melted her heart. Prabhupada told us we should keep Krishna in the center. That is the solution. When we keep Krishna in the center, then everything becomes auspicious. Even the impossible can take place.
Next we find Dhruva Maharaj
is being embraced by his real mother, Suniti.
How much she must have suffered.
We read previously in this story,
when Suniti heard how Dhruva was insulted by his stepmother, her heart was broken. When she saw Dhruva Maharaj with his lips quivering in anger, but that anger was not just an ordinary type of anger. He was a Kshatriya. It was his way of responding to his heart being shattered into millions of pieces. He was so hurt. Different people respond to pain in their heart in different ways. Some people, when their heart is broken, when they're in a miserable, suffering state inflicted by others, some people just go into a secluded place and don't say anything to anyone and just cry. Other people just somehow or other try to keep busy and forget it. But Dhruva as a Kshatriya, he became angry as fire. But the mother didn't see really his anger. She saw his broken heart. This was just a superficial reaction to the pain of his heart, that he wanted revenge. But mothers don't care for those things. They're concerned with the heart. Just like the example of Ashwatthama. Ashwatthama killed the 5 sons of Draupadi. So Draupadi was a mother. She knew what it was like to lose her sons, how much she suffered. So when Arjuna was about to kill Ashwatthama, she said, "No, no, don't kill him." Bhima was wild. "What is this, don't kill him? He killed our children. According to justice, he must be killed." She said, "No, no, you cannot kill this boy. He may have done what he has done, but his mother, Kripi, she's a noble lady. She's the wife of our guru. She should not have to suffer the way I'm suffering. I had only 5 children, they're dead. She has only 1 children. she'll be motherless. Why should she suffer like me? Let the child go. This was her compassion. And she was a Kshatriya woman too. But her motherliness took prominence. As a mother, she was unbearably suffering due to her children's death. Now, in this material world, misery likes company. If you're suffering, you want at least everyone to suffer, equal to or better than you. And even if somebody's happy, if you're suffering, sometimes you just speak and do things in such a way to make them suffer. Because you can't tolerate that somebody else is happy when you're suffering. Everyone should suffer like me. But a devotee is paradukaduki. A devotee, no matter what condition he is in, he's more concerned with the condition of others. So Draupadi said, release him. So they embarrassed him by cutting his hairs in certain ways and treating him in a certain way that destroyed his false pride. I mean, it just devastated him, his ego. He was so disturbed, worse than death, by humiliating him the way they did. But the mother, creepy, she didn't care if he was humiliated. She just was happy that he was alive. So Suniti, she wasn't so much concerned with the anger and disturbance that was manifesting in Dhruva. She was concerned with his heart. He was hurt. He was inflicted. He was suffering. She suffered more than him seeing that because she was a great person. She suffered more than Dhruva. That is the nature of a real mother. Kunti suffered more than the Pandavas during their 12 years of exile because she had to see it and hear about what they had to go through. And then when she saw her child, 5 years old, go into the forest, we have discussed Uttanapada's reaction to that, the father. How much more she was inflicted by thinking her son has gone to the forest. You know how mothers think. Where will you eat? They're always worried about what you're eating and whether you're getting enough sleep and whether you have warm enough clothes. Isn't every mother like that? Sometimes it's really too much the way mothers are. You just want to escape. Did you get enough? Yes, I got enough to eat. Well, take more. No, no more. Well, you didn't eat your spinach. I don't like spinach. Make sure you're dressed warm. Did you get enough sleep? Get enough sleep. Go back to sleep. Mothers are like that. So what is Suniti? Her son is living in the jungle all alone, month after month after month. Is he alive? Is he dead? How will he survive? And now Dhruva Maharaj is returning home. And it is describing Suniti. She was in such ecstasy that she was embracing the tender body of her son, who was dearer to her than her own life. And thus she forgot all material grief, for she was very pleased. The ecstasy of union after separation is far more intensified than simply being with the object of love. This is a spiritual principle. Sambhog and Vipralamba. This is how Krishna deals with his devotees, especially in Vrindavan. He's together with them to increase their love. And then he separates himself from them to further increase their love. And that separation makes the reunion even all that much more wonderful. Rupa Goswami calls it yoga and ayoga. Union and separation from the Lord, and how they are both complementing each other perfectly to simply increase the relationship's intensity of affection. So here we find these two great spiritual personalities, Suniti and Dhruva. They are meeting 5 months of separation under those circumstances must have seemed like millenniums for the mother. But now her son is back. Not only is he safe and sound in his body, but he's a completely self-realized soul. They already heard from Narada Muni that he saw Lord Vishnu face to face. His heart was completely pure. When he came back, there was no vengeance, there was no lust, there was nothing in his heart except pure love. He was completely detached from anything except the desire to serve. It describes how Suniti, the tears of her eyes mixed with the milk of motherly affection flowing from her breasts to perform Abhishekam to Dhruva Maharaj. What a beautiful sight this must be. We can see it through our ears at this very moment. Milk from her breast out of intense, ecstatic motherly affection. Milk mixing with the water from her eyes. Srila Prabhupada explains that there are two types of tears. Tears of distress and the tears of happiness. Tears of distress are hot tears. And tears of happiness are cooling tears. So these were cooling tears. They were tears of joy, swelling from her eyes incessantly. And our great acharyas, represented by Srila Prabhupada in this purport, are describing how this was actually indication that Dhruva Maharaj would be king. It was like the preliminary Abhishek. Because when you coronate someone as king, there is Abhishek for the king. We read in Ramayana by Valmiki Muni, when Ramchandra returned after 14 years in Chitrakoot and the Dandakaranya forest, Vishishta Muni and the other great rishis, they performed Abhishekam for Ram by bathing his body in all the auspicious substances, Panchagavya, Panchamrita. So the indication that Dhruva Maharaj would soon be king of the planet is herein being revealed through the Abhishek of love by his mother to him. And Srila Prabhupada quotes from this translation how Suniti is described as the mother of a great hero. The nature of human society is to idolize and be very much influenced by persons who are heroes. And somehow or other, human society needs heroes. They just have to have heroes. Otherwise, they can't really survive. It's just such a deep, deep need of the heart. Why is that? Because Krishna is the supreme hero. He's the supreme personality of Godhead. He's the ultimate hero. But because we have forgotten him, we have to replace that need to idolize someone, to worship someone, or for some people to be envious of someone. But we just need somebody up there to glorify, to worship, to idolize in various ways. So Srila Prabhupada explains that different classes of people select different people to be their heroes. Prabhupada says they select different people to be their Mahajans. Mahajan is a hero. It's like certain atheistic scientists. Their hero is Charles Darwin. They will quote him. They worship his genius, hypothesis of the evolution of species, and his hero. And they quote him as authority. Prabhupada says, I kick his face with boot. Prabhupada didn't see him as hero. Why does Prabhupada want to kick his face with boot? What is this? We're supposed to be nonviolent. Prabhupada didn't mean it literally. He meant it figuratively. Because Prabhupada never wore boots in his whole life. He wore very soft canvas little shoes, or plastic shoes. But actually, by saying that, he's attracting mercy upon Darwin. This is described by our acharyas. Vrindavan Das Thakur, he said like this also. Anybody who criticizes Nityananda Prabhu, I kick him in the head with my foot. Why Vrindavan Das Thakur wants to kick people in heads with foot? He doesn't want to kick people's head. But by saying that, he's showing such an interest in that person that Krishna is going to give special mercy to that person. If my devotee is thinking like this of that person, I better give special mercy to that person. So actually, who can understand the incredible, pious credits that Darwin achieved by Prabhupada talking about him like that? Somewhere his soul is being delivered by Prabhupada's nectarine words. And Prabhupada explains in one purport that some people thought Hitler was their hero. In Germany at that time, in the 1930s, he was the hero of the whole land. Everyone was glorifying him. They were having practically, it wasn't Sankirtan at all, but they were all chanting together, "Hail, hail! Sikai, Sikai!" like that. And they were all together, raising their arm together, chanting the same name of their god together. The whole nation was glorifying. They looked up to him as their savior. Whatever he said, they did. Whatever he wanted, they wanted. Because of that human weakness, they need a hero, but they repose it in the wrong person. When I was young, the President of the United States was hero of everyone. And that's not like that so much anymore. But everyone looked up. And now the people make heroes out of athletes. Yes. Here in India, cricket players. I don't know what they do, but if they can do it better than someone else, they become heroes. I remember that time we were in Belgaum, and hundreds of children and young people were just looking for the cricket star. They were expecting him any moment. They looked in the car and saw us, and they were totally disappointed. Hero. And in the West, the most popular people is someone who can jump high and throw balls far. They're heroes. Anything, any clothes they wear, it will sell millions. Any shoes they wear, it will sell millions. Any toothpaste they use, everyone will brush their teeth the same way. Really, we have seen. Or other people make heroes out of people who act nicely. That's really strange, isn't it? It's people who are good actors. People who are expert at being someone other than themselves. That's what acting is about, is it not? Being so convincing and absorbed in a role of being someone other than yourself. Well, that's what the whole world's about, trying to be someone other than yourself. So if someone can really do it really good, then they've become our hero. That's the psychology. We're the eternal soul. We're thinking we're this body. We're thinking I'm Indian, I'm American, I'm from New Zealand. Let me act in this role of being this body. And let me be the enjoyer, let me be the sufferer of the experiences of this body. So everybody's absorbed in that role. It's actually a role. It's not a reality. Someone who's their body, who can actually pretend to be somebody who's not even them, in the bodily case, that's just an extension of acting an artificial role. So those people become very, very much heroes. And whatever they do, people look up to. We see in the hoardings here in Bombay, we see some movie actor saying, "This is the car I drive." And everybody buys the car. "This is the biscuits I eat." "This is the clothes I wear." "Yes. This is the coconut oil I put in my hair." So everyone wants to do. It's the nature of the world. These people get paid so much. I met one famous television star some years ago, and he told me he made $20,000 a week for his television station, and about 2-3 times more than that in endorsements. Endorsements means you just take a photo for a few minutes, you know, I buy this brand of stainless steel. I use this microphone. It's like that. Heroes. People look up to someone. But who are the real heroes? We all have to have heroes. We just have to face it. It's human nature. If we make our hero a person who will help us to love God, that is the perfection of life. Thus, Lord Kapila Dev has said that the same attraction you have for so many of the society, friendship, love, and the so many pleasures of this world, if you just transfer it to a sadhu, your life will be perfect. So here in America, people had so many heroes. Politicians, scientists, philosophers, movie actors and actresses, athletes, social activists, military people, and then Prabhupada comes. And he became hero. He became hero for people. And his influence. People gave up illicit sex, intoxication, gambling, meat eating. People started chanting the holy names of God constantly. People actually surrendered to Krishna because they heroized Prabhupada as a great soul. And the more people understood the glories of Srila Prabhupada, the more the world became Krishna conscious. Because he was teaching people who is the supreme hero, Krishna. People are famous if they're good wrestlers. Krishna defeated Chanura and Mustika, the world champions. People are heroes if they're good dancers. Krishna was dancing on Kaliya's hoods. He was dancing in Rasleela with gopis so beautifully. People are heroes if they're good musicians. When Krishna played his flute, we don't see any of these musicians, whether they're classical Indian musicians, or what is those other ghazals? What are they called? Yes? Singing those things. Or whether they're singing rock and roll or soul or blues, or whether they're singing country and western, or whether they're singing Japanese hymns. We don't see anyone singing, anyone playing any instruments that has the effect of Krishna. When Krishna sings, people's hearts melt in ecstasy. When Krishna plays upon his flute, the Jamuna reverses its flow, goes the opposite direction to come back to hear more. Dear Samir, that place in Vrindavan, Krishna was playing his flute, and the breeze which was flying by didn't want to go anywhere else. The breeze just stayed right where it was to hear Krishna play flute. The inanimate objects like trees were trembling in ecstasy. The rocks were trembling in ecstasy. And the animate objects like animals and humans became stunned like stone. Even the beetles couldn't do that. So Krishna, supreme musician, supreme lover. People are attracted to romantic people. Krishna is supreme. Knowledge. Some people heroize very intelligent people who can speak very elucid, who know so much scripture. Krishna spoke Bhagavad Gita. Krishna is a supreme reservoir of all knowledge. So a real hero in this world who can actually help us is those people who bring us to the supreme hero, Krishna. And if we can dovetail that propensity to idolize Vaishnavas, then our life will become perfect. And the whole world will be purified because they're bringing everyone to Krishna. When Lord Chaitanya asked Ramananda Rai, who is the most famous man in the whole world? Ramananda replied, anyone who is known as a great devotee of the Lord is to be accepted as the most famous. famous. The six Goswamis of Vrindavan. They were loved by everyone, the gentle, the ruffians, because of their compassion, because of their love, because of their concern for every living being's welfare. So these are our heroes. When we describe the glories of Krishna, the glories of the great acharyas, and we influence other people to understand that this is really the standard of a great personality, then we can actually change the direction of the world. Is there any questions? Yes, Prabhu.
Thank you for a very wonderful class, Maharaj. When Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was discussing with Ramananda Roy, he asked, who is the most famous man in the world? So can you please describe the circumstances surrounding this conversation and more details of the answers given?
There's no need. We should understand that principle because that is the subject of this verse. Ramananda Rai is a pure servant of Lord Chaitanya. And Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was asking questions of Ramananda Rai. This is an extremely deep subject matter because he wanted to glorify his devotee. He was actually speaking through Ramananda Rai. Ramananda Rai said, actually, I don't even know what I'm saying. I'm just like an instrument and you are like the musician making sounds come out of me. So Lord Chaitanya wanted to teach the world through the mouth of his own devotee. And he asked him a series of these questions to enlighten human society. And the question that Prabhupada is citing here is about who is famous. So it is Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself, Krishna himself, through the mouth of his own devotee speaking, who we should actually see as great. It is a lesson. Because according to who we see as great, we're going to model our life accordingly. Is somebody great who can sexually agitate others by the way they look, by the way they speak? Is that a great person in this society? Yes, that's a great person. I read in the newspapers here in India when President Clinton came here. Actually, the newspapers, Times of India and other newspapers were saying when he was here, instead of talking about whether he was a great politician or whether he was a great commander-in-chief of the military or whether he was a great person leading the society in the path of Dharma, they talk about what a handsome lover he was, what a romantic type of a person he was. Hare Krishna, what does that have to do with anything he's supposed to be doing? People are so idiotic and ignorant. This is what they're thinking is great. Someone who agitates you. Someone who brings your consciousness down to the animalistic level. That person is great. But actually a real great person is a person who elevates your consciousness to the transcendental platform. That's the purpose of human life. Human life is to get above the animalistic instincts and actually realize your transcendental nature as an eternal soul, as a lover of God. So one who can do that is actually great. They could actually do great things. Yes, Radhe Shyam Prabhu.
Maharaj, it appears Suruchi also experienced a change of heart and now she has given up her wrong attitude towards Dhruva and Uttama also. But subsequently we hear they both also die, I think, after they both leave their bodies, Suruchi and her son Uttama. Afterwards, was it given as a punishment or is it due to some other reason? Because now it appears that they have, like Suruchi has had a change of heart and she is also embracing Dhruva.
It is explained in various ways, but it was a reaction to their offenses in one sense. But in another sense, because of their relationship with Dhruva Maharaj, even though they may have taken some reaction on a bodily level, their souls are going to be elevated. Because of Dhruva Maharaj's mercy, their souls will be elevated, even though on a physical, karmic level, they may have to get some karmic reaction for the offenses that were committed. Similarly, if we surrender to Krishna, sometimes our body has to go through certain things that it just should have gone through. It's just supposed to have gone through. But even passing through that, if we're in the proper state of consciousness, we'll go back to Godhead. We'll make advancement through that process. Great devotees sometimes go through inflictions of the body, which may be a reaction to something in the past. But because of their good consciousness, because of the blessings and the mercy upon them, they'll pass through that situation and make great advancement. And even if they die, they will be promoted to the transcendental position. So, on a worldly level, there may have been some reaction for the offense to Dhruva Maharaj. However, on the spiritual level, which is the eternal level of reality, they will get the benefit and the credit of the mercy of Dhruva Maharaj upon them. Does that answer your question? Yeah, we have to see that even great personalities in this world, or even ourselves, we take to Krishna consciousness. Krishna may want to teach the world a lesson by some karmic situation through this instance, but at the same time, the soul is being delivered. Yes, Prabhu.
We saw that how Dhruva Maharaj, by his spiritual practice, he overcome all a revengeful attitude. But when the Lord benedicted him with kingship, he says that since all the demigods who are situated in the higher planetary system will have to come down again, they are all envious of my being elevated to Vaikuntha Loka by my devotional service. These intolerant demigods have dissipated my intelligence, and only for this reason could I not accept the genuine benediction of the instruction of sage Narada.
Which text is this?
Text number 32. And he is very assertively saying that it's only there the cause. So how is that? He is blaming someone else other than himself.
In this instance, Narada Muni told Dhruva to go home and be transcendental to his mother's harsh words. But Dhruva Maharaj could not accept. He said, I'm a Kshatriya. These words of forgiveness and being beyond the dualities do not sit in my heart. I must get revenge. So Narada Muni actually gave him transcendental knowledge by which he would have been liberated if he followed. But because he wasn't in a state to follow those, he gave him another instruction by which he would be liberated and attain the ultimate perfection of life. So Dhruva Maharaj is ashamed. He's ashamed. It is explains in previous verses and in or other verses of this chapter how Dhruva Maharaj was personally very, very ashamed. He wasn't blaming others. He was really personally ashamed that he approached God for material benedictions. But here really what he's doing is he's preaching. Dhruva Maharaj is just explaining the facts. He's not blaming others for his own weakness. He's just explaining the facts, the realities. That's what Prabhupada brings out in the purport. He doesn't say that Dhruva Maharaj is blaming the demigods. He's just stating that this is a fact. The demigods do this. Huh? So we should see it that way. He's saying, since all the demigods are situated in the higher planet systems, will have to come down again. They are envious of my being elevated to Vaikuntha Loka. These intolerant demigods have dissipated my intelligence, and only for this reason could I not accept the genuine benediction of the instructions of the sage Narada. Because if he would have surrendered to Narada, he would have attained Vaikuntha then. Huh? he would attain higher planet than the demigods in that sense. So we see Vishwamitra Muni, we see Narayan Rishi, they were performing tapasya, and the demigods, headed by Indra, tried everything they could to make him fall down, because they were envious of him. They were fearful that he would attain power by which he could conquer them. So Dhruva Maharaj, rather than see that he's blaming the demigods here, because he's obviously taking responsibility himself in other verses, showing shame, what he's actually doing is he's just stating the facts, that these are the way the demigods are, and this is what they did to me. It's like if Narayan Rishi was asked, you know, did Indra send Cupid to make you fall down? He would say, yes, he did. This is what he did, because he's envious. He wouldn't say, no, it's all my fault. He may say that. Dhruva's also saying that, but he's also stating the facts. Huh? He's differentiating a pure devotee from a mixed devotee. Not necessarily all the demigods are pure devotees. Some of them are fearful and envious of their material prosperity. And they do pollute the intelligence of others so that they can't actually attain higher perfections. Isn't Kamadev a sort of a demigod? Yes? Isn't he trying to interfere with your spiritual life sometimes? So what are we? Maybe our fault, but still, Kamadev's doing something up there. He's doing everything he can to pollute my intelligence and keep me from going back to Vaikuntha. Yes, so it's a fact. So we say it. We all say it. Yes, Kamadev is doing. Indra sends Kamadev, so we understand. Indra's fearful. He's insecure of his situation. We shouldn't think in this verse that Dhruva's blaming others, because he's already admitted the blame in other verses. What he's doing here is he's differentiating between the pure devotees and the mixed devotees. Even great personalities, they're trying to make great souls fall down. That's their nature. That's their psychological nature. To fear of people becoming greater than them, they try to make people fall down. That's just reality. And it's a reality we all have to face in trying to become pure devotees. Because the modes of nature and the phenomena of material nature is always trying to pollute us, is it? And who is material nature being controlled by? Demigods. Hare Krishna. Does that answer your question? You have any comment on that, Panditji, Sri Radha Gopinath Prabhu? He said the demigods have stolen his intelligence. The demigods, they're not so interested in me because I don't have anything to steal. But in your case, you are being blessed by Krishna, and therefore the demigods are showering flowers upon you. Thank you very much.